Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast. This is the On the Spot series by China Forum. In this series, we return to the platform of international forums and webinars where leading minds in academia, government, business, technology, and media deliver novel, collaborative responses to the global issues of the day.
Hello and welcome to CISS podcast, On the Spot series. This is Beibei with China Forum. As politicians and scholars from across the world gathered in Beijing in early 2024 to attend various international forums where they exchange ideas and thoughts about current international relations and ways out for some urgent regional conflicts, I got the chance to bring some of them to our podcast to share their thinking with our listeners. In the following days, we'll release interviews with six scholars from China and abroad, conducted on the sidelines of the 6th International Forum on Security and Strategy, which was organized by CISS Tsinghua University on March 27, 2024. Joining me today is Dr. Michael Vatikiotis, Senior Advisor at the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue, based in Singapore. As we dive deep into the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, Ukraine, and Afghanistan, as we discuss the role of China and ASEAN countries in propelling dynamic growth in the region, as well as participating in global affairs like combating climate change, hope we'll all have a better understanding of China's stance in many international affairs. Here we have Dr. Michael Vatikiotis. Hello, Dr. Vatikiotis. We're so happy to have you for our forum and for our podcast interview. And actually, I've never seen so many different names of places and countries in one person's introduction, which gives us a picture of the breadth of your international experience. Mm-hmm. So you currently serve as the senior advisor
for the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue. I've worked for the center for 20 years.
For 20 years, yeah. Wow. So in the past few years, we've been bombarded with news about what's happening in Ukraine, and also more recently the Middle East conflict, which I assume to be just two of the hot spots among other crises going on in the world. But I don't think we hear enough about the related humanitarian situations, their needs on the ground, the realities on the ground that define these situations as crises. So could you shed some light on what's going on the ground, what's happening to the people there in Ukraine, in Gaza, in Afghanistan, or, you know, climate issues, etc.?
Well, of the countries that you list, I think it's probably most important to talk about the Middle East and Gaza situation, which is the most serious humanitarian crisis I think the world has faced in many, many decades, at least in terms of the concentration of suffering and the inability to address the situation. In terms of Ukraine and other parts of the world, I would mention Ethiopia, for instance, which is, you know, on the brink of another very serious humanitarian crisis, and Sudan, where more than 8 million people have been displaced, and there are serious humanitarian concerns. And in fact, there's a real danger that the Gaza situation overshadows some of these other important areas. Mm-hmm. But to speak of Gaza, since I've just returned from the Middle East after spending more than 3 weeks in the region, and of course not in Gaza, no one, I think, really has very much access to Gaza itself. But what I can say is there are two immediate priorities. The first is to understand that the main problem is access at the moment. You know, there's plenty of food and there's plenty of support for addressing the humanitarian situation, which is essentially starvation in Gaza, not to mention the deprivation of the public health facilities, which are very, very badly affected by the war. And the main problem with access, of course, is that Israel is preventing access to Gaza of the enormous amount of aid that is available to feed people, you know, almost 2 million people in Gaza, who are starving. And so this is a serious situation, no one has been able to address.
You mentioned there is enough food.
Yeah,
but where is the food?
The food is on the border. Yeah, so it's lined up in trucks ready to go in.
While people are starving.
While people are starving, yeah. And all the international agencies have been more or less unable to address the situation. Just yesterday, a UN security resolution was finally approved by the Security Council with only one abstention by the United States, which effectively means that for the first time on the UN Security Council, a call for immediate ceasefire, which has broad support. So we'll have to see what that means in the coming days and weeks. A related problem, which is, I think, very serious, is that the main organization that has been providing food, education, public health, social security for all the Palestinian refugees in the region, that's more than 6 million of them, which is the United Nations Relief and Works Association, has had much of its funding cut after Israel accused UNRWA of harboring Hamas activists in its staff. This has so far gone unproven, but nonetheless the United States in particular, but many other countries, withdrew their funding from UNRWA. And UNRWA is the only organization on the ground that has the capacity immediately to address the concerns of the Gazans, but not just in Gaza, also, you know, 4 million or so, 5 million or so other Palestinians and people in Jordan and Lebanon in refugee camps. And so that's a very serious concern. It's not just Gaza, it's also the other parts of the region that harbor refugees.
So there are many layers to the problem.
Many layers.
And the root of the problem is that nobody can go in. Is there any solution to this, to get things inside to the people who really
need it? No, and the solution is for the State of Israel to comply with UN Security Council concerns about the humanitarian situation, to provide the access, not just to the aid going in, but to aid workers going in to help. And that so far has not happened.
And the funding, besides sources from the U.S., what are other sources?
Well, that's a good question, because in fact the U.S. provides almost, $350 million a year to UNRWA, which is the bulk of its donation. Mm-hmm. There is a need for other countries to step up their contributions to make up for the shortfall, which is now, I think the U.S. Congress has now passed a bill that makes it illegal to fund UNRWA for the next year.
Dear.
So there is an urgent need for the funding to make up the loss of this contribution. Some countries have stepped up. Some countries have resumed their funding. Mm. There's a need for a great deal more.
So that's why we need more countries, more people to hear the situation on the ground. And even if the funding, let's say the funding is in place, will that be able to actually help the people in Gaza?
There is a war situation. And so that is a good question. You know, to what extent, other than just delivering food, would it be possible, for instance, to address the immense trauma? There's terrible injuries that people have suffered, the restoration of full hospital services, and so on and so forth. That is actually a very serious issue, because in the current situation, the Israeli Defense Forces controls the ground, and they will also control levels of access, and they will also control the restoration of healthcare.
Well, my heart feels very heavy hearing all these. During China's two sessions, which just ended earlier this month, our foreign minister, Wang Yi, once again called for a release of all people detained at the Palestinian-Israel conflict, a stop to behavior harming civilians, as well as full implementation of the two-state solution. And also, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also highlighted the need for a global order that works for everyone. But it seems like some major powers are just stuck at the for everyone part. You know, a global order that works for me, yes. But a global order that works for my neighbor or other party, not so much. So what do you think it would take to mold an element of compromise into this mindset? Is it possible?
Yeah, that's a very complex question, but it's a very good one. You know, before October 7th, we were facing a very polarized world, in particular between the two big superpowers, the US and China, but also many parts of the world affected by conflict of one sort or another. Now, since October 7th, we have this very much bigger threat of conflict, wider conflict in the Middle East. And it seems that there is simply no capacity anymore to immediately apply a system or a process by which the parties to conflict can be brought together to discuss de-escalation, to discuss addressing humanitarian needs, and then also the security arrangements. So the very notion of a peace process, or the way in which conflicts like this can be reduced and reach a resolution, has almost become unreachable at the present time. Mm. Now, one can blame geopolitics, you know, as you said, you can blame the sort of selfishness of big powers and so on. But I think what's important to realize is that the emergence of these multiple crises has put enormous pressure on the international system. So I think the first thing to say is that the international system, the multilateral system, is simply no longer capable of dealing with these crises in the way that in the past they may have done, particularly the United Nations, concerts of powers, alliances. And, you know, there are political pressures, that enhance and increase polarization. You know, there are geopolitical factors, there are local factors, and, you know, the whole process by which the world was governed by a set of international rules, you know, is simply just evaporated. And so it's a huge problem. And the second set of issues related to that is, of course, that because of global crisis, very few people have much idea about what to do about it. You know, there's no organizing set of actors that are sort of saying, well, let's, you know, let's, I mean, apart from saying in the case of the Middle East, oh, the two-state solution, but what does that mean? What does it actually amount to in terms of a process of negotiation? And what are the alternatives if that's not going to work? And so there's a deficit of ideas. And then thirdly, I think it's fair to say that because we've grown so accustomed to this very polarized world, the basic contact between the various actors, main actors, is often very limited. You know, people don't sit down and talk as often as they used to. You know, diplomacy has become very hard. It seems there's a lot of rhetorical statement, there's a great deal of everyone running around saying we're in a crisis, but actually people don't sit and talk to one another the way that they used to. And so it is a huge problem. I don't think in today or at any time, you know, that I can think of in my life, we've ever faced such a huge crisis of confidence in global rules and order.
It sounds like a severe stress test on the international system, on the current international system, and hopefully new ways of doing international relations can emerge.
Well, I mean, if there's a space to do so, I think you're right that there is a need for some new thinking and some new frameworks, but no one's really had the chance to sort of sit down and figure out what they are, what should they be. You know, there are very few forums in which people say, okay, let's redesign the international system to make it more fit for purpose. You know, later, I think this year or maybe next year, the United Nations will host something what it calls the Summit of the Future, which is supposed to be a framework in which changes to the multilateral system can be formulated and addressed. But that's going to be run by the UN. So I think it's important to sort of come up with some new ideas. And for that, there need to be different forums, perhaps in different parts of the world. We've more recently seen the emergence of the Global South as an important factor. I mean, there are some new players in the world who are beginning to assert themselves and say, well, look, you know, the current system is not working. International law is not being respected.
Right.
You've seen South Africa, I would say Indonesia, Brazil, you know, have come forward to sort of say, look, enough is enough. We have to change the way we do things.
So you do believe that we should talk more between different countries? Because in times of crisis, that's when people are kind of running around in a frenzy and people seems like they don't have time to sit down. They think this is not the time to talk. This is the time to act. But you do think that we should communicate more so that people can understand and also through dialogue to find better solutions.
Yeah, exactly. Dialogue and also the space in which communication and dialogue can take place in a rational and constructive manner.
And also, can you tell us a little bit about what's happening in Afghanistan? Because I think we haven't heard.
Not really my area.
Overshadowed.
I mean, I think the only thing I would say is that it's clearly a country that has been more or less neglected by the proliferation of crises that have happened since 2020. And I think the world has sort of moved on, unfortunately. So I think you're right to raise it. I think it's really incumbent on the rest of the world to pay more attention, which is hard in the current circumstances because of other crises.
Yeah. I want to move on to ASEAN, Southeastern Asian countries. So you have 35 years of experience of living and working in Asia, and ASEAN as a region of unparalleled diversity in its ethnicity, language, religion, its political system, and its economy. We see relative peace and also even dynamic economic growth. It demonstrates the possibility of the power of unity amidst diversity. So can you tell us a little bit about your experience of living and working in such a dynamic and diverse environment?
Well, when I first arrived in Southeast Asia in the early 1980s, I think it's fair to say that we were still used to seeing this part of the world as emerging or developing. And it was used to be called the Third World. And by about the mid-1980s, you started to see tremendous levels of growth and investment, led to some extent by Japan, but also Western countries. And by the early or mid-1990s, certainly China came into the frame in terms of investment. You know, while the governments of the 10 countries of Southeast Asia were hugely varied in terms of the methods of governing and degrees to which people were given representation. Irrespective of those differences, it's fair to say that all the 10 countries of Southeast Asia more or less started to deliver levels of welfare and prosperity to their populations that has enabled, in spite of political differences, all the countries to achieve a measure of increasing levels of consumption, levels of investment, which has allowed these countries to really grow at tremendous rates and to provide a degree of security, human security, for their populations, which has led to this relative stability. For instance, Indonesia today now has a more or less functioning public health system, which, you know, 10, 15 years ago would have been unthinkable. You know, but now if you are sick and you're an Indonesian citizen, you will get looked after. There is a sort of social welfare system in place.
So the key is to put people's needs first?
Yes, and to provide security for people. Now, of course, there follows, you know, issues of political representation, decentralization, autonomy. And for the most part, some of those issues, a lot of those issues have been sorted out or in the process of being sorted out. I mean, what was once a landscape of subnational conflict across Southeast Asia has more or less been, with some exceptions, been resolved. And of course, the huge exception to all of this is Myanmar. The country is in the state of fragmentation as we speak. And so I think with the exception of Myanmar, all the countries of Southeast Asia have achieved, as you characterized it, a relative sort of degree of stability and peace.
Can you summarize for us, do you think, the keys for achieving this relative peace so that other regions in the world can probably learn from this? Because I don't think ASEAN gets enough spotlight.
You're right, and that's largely because they've stayed out of the limelight in terms of crisis. I think to summarize, it really has been, despite the differences in political systems, all the governments, because of the high density of population, and have provided levels of security that have enabled prosperity to occur. And also, I think, location. I mean, Southeast Asia is located between India and China. It is on huge major trade routes. It benefits from trade. And there are varying degrees of openness. By and large, Southeast Asia has been open to trade. And I would say another factor, which is often neglected, is that Southeast Asia has tried to maintain balanced relations with everyone. There is this deep and abiding instinct in Southeast Asia to avoid taking sides and to create this sort of balance between relations of external powers.
Who is doing that balancing?
It's sort of instinctive in Southeast Asia.
For each of the countries?
Each of the countries. I mean, it's a very unaligned, I don't use the word non-aligned, it's a very unaligned part of the world. But as we know from the case of Thailand, you know, they manage relationships very well with China and with India and with everyone. You know, it's maintaining this balance and not becoming part of global conflict.
I think you mentioned trade, which I think is important, not just for fostering prosperity, but also for maintaining peaceful relationships. How do you think the Belt and Road Initiative figure into maintaining or fostering more trade in Southeast Asia?
Well, we can't look at the Belt and Road in isolation. I mean, with regard to Southeast Asia, China has been moving into a situation where there is very close trade and investment relations for some two decades now. Belt and Road, in a way, was something that was a bit more ambitious going beyond Southeast Asia. The Belt and Road passes through Southeast Asia. But Southeast Asia, the neighboring countries of China in particular, have long been places that China has encouraged trade and investment. I remember many years ago as a journalist writing a story about the possibility of the renminbi becoming a tradable currency in the region. This has not happened. But, you know, I think Southeast Asia is very much in the vicinity of China, in the hinterland of China, and therefore one can always expect close trade and investment relations. The complication in more recent years has been, of course, geopolitics, but also China itself developed its own huge consumer market, and it became a vast economy in its own right. And I think that also changed the relationship with neighboring countries a little bit. The consumer market is here. And it cuts both ways. Belt and Road, of course, came along as something that enhances all that. But as I said, I think it's seen mostly as passing through Southeast Asia and has a much broader sort of international scope.
But I'm looking forward to easier travel time from China to other southeastern countries. And also, I'm looking forward to more fruit and other exotic products coming in from ASEAN countries. I think it will be easier in the coming years.
Yeah, you know, and then today, everywhere in the world, they export very efficiently, you know, their produce and so on. So I think if one has to look at some of the challenges that lie ahead, I would say that, you know, as we see in Europe today, if governments start to provide for their people, there's a cost related to that. And so it's important for Southeast Asia to calibrate in the right way how much governments are willing to bear the cost of providing social services. And I think, you know, we're looking in many countries that are sort of hybrid, you know, where people pay, but the state pays some. Now, I don't think in Southeast Asia, places like Singapore, which helps its citizens a lot, there's, I think, a very sensible approach to this. Is, you know, governments can't be expected to pay for everything. And I think the private sector plays a very important role. The state sector is somewhat governed by the desire of the private sector to remain very much in the lead. And so as long as the governments have this very sensible approach to how to manage society, how to deal with the challenges of the information age, of social media and so on, I think, you know, Southeast Asia will continue to be relatively well governed. I mean, we can talk about the political challenges and they come and go, but I've always felt that Southeast Asian societies are relatively well governed. And when they're poorly governed, change surely happens.
So some keywords I can sense from what you just said is balance. Balance is the key, and also putting people's basic needs first, and other problems will solve themselves much easier in a way.
In general.
In general. All right, great. Other things we should be also reminded of, like climate issues?
It's a very good point to raise climate, because Southeast Asia and China are part of the same problem in different ways. The way I see it is that climate change and concerns about climate change have not yet reached appreciable levels of concern in Southeast Asia, which is something that cannot last for very long. We see across mainland Southeast Asia in particular, alarming rises in temperature that are affecting most of the areas that produce the most food. The rice-growing areas of the Irrawaddy Delta, the Mekong sub-region, the Red River Delta in Vietnam, they're all suffering very high increases in temperature, daily average temperature.
Are the local people aware of the
climate
issues?
People are aware. I mean, some areas they're leaving.
They're leaving there.
They're leaving. I mean, if daily average temperatures exceed 45 degrees Celsius for more than 20 or 30 days a year, it's very hard to actually conduct agriculture. You have water supply problems.
Simply to survive.
You have, you know, human survivability. Now, guess where these people are going to head? Because, you know, the parts of the continent that are less affected by climate change are going to be in the borderlands of China and India, in the foothills of the Himalayas. And so, yes, people will head north. Climate change is a human problem in that it causes displacement, and displacement causes conflict and transboundary issues.
So it's not just sitting here saying that, oh, that area has gotten a lot hotter, and you can sort of keep the distance from it. It will come to impact
other
people.
It will impact human society and therefore human behavior, and therefore produce conflict, unless it's well managed. And last year, I think, in the Irrawaddy Delta in Myanmar, there were about 10 days in excess of 40 degrees centigrade. That's already very high. And, you know, I spend a lot of time in Thailand, where in the hot season, it sometimes reaches 45 degrees centigrade in the city. And that's when they measure, you know, the measurements are not actual temperatures. You know, actual temperatures may be
higher.
Right,
it's usually higher with the sun on the pavement.
Yeah, so it's a serious problem.
Well, anything more optimistic? Like, are people acting to help?
Well, as I said earlier, the problem is so much not what people feel they ought to be doing. It's whether or not there are the institutions and frameworks in which people can be effective in terms of expressing concern and doing something about the problem. And so I think we really need to pay more attention. And I would sort of, you know, end by saying I think there's a tremendous expectation in the world that China can play a more important role in multilateral affairs. I just came back from the Middle East, where, you know, China's role in the Middle East is seen as something that people want to see more of.
I see.
I think people will be watching, you know, with some expectation, the extent to which China can play a more important role in moderating the situation. I believe that the main challenge for China is how to overcome its aversion to risk. Many of these problems are, of course, very difficult. They're not easy to resolve. And I think China's approach has been very cautious. And therefore, I think very difficult for China to move quickly into this area. But I think there are certainly the expectation, as we saw in March last year, there was an agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran that China helped bring about. Mm-hmm. I think people expect to see China play a more positive role in that respect.
It has made great progress.
Some progress.
More. But it's also because, you know, some other countries are so sensitive when China gets on to the center of the world stage, right?
It's true. I mean, there's some pushback. But I do think it's possible to do more. And I think, you know, quiet diplomacy is usually the best way. We've seen some of that with regard to Iran. Right. You know, I think there's an expectation that China should play a bigger role in resolving the problems between Ukraine and Russia. Mm-hmm. There are geopolitical obstacles to that, too.
Right.
But I think as long as there is the demand, I think it would be useful to continue to engage with China on sort of what more can be done.
So more organization at the international level, more balancing, and more common sense.
For all mankind, yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Good. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
That was my conversation with Dr. Michael Vatikiotis, Senior Advisor at the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue, based in Singapore. You're welcome to stay tuned to more conversations of this series in our coming episodes. Thank you.